Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the Econ Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And I'm pretty pumped for this week's episode. Joining me is the founder of a company called Metric, Bryce Adams. I first connected with him, man, maybe 2 or 3 years into his journey over the last decade of building his company. Metric, if you haven't heard about it, is an analytics platform, reporting platform, and email marketing suite for Shopify and WooCommerce stores. And we talk a lot about e-com. He is plugged into 3,000 stores in real time, just released a really cool report on a lot of the metrics that he sees. So we get into that, and that's all fascinating. But the thing that I think is most interesting about Bryce's story is he's built a very meaningful, extremely profitable company over a decade, bootstrapped with three other team members solely. He's the fourth. And he's done it with such an intentionality on focus and building something meaningful and high quality. His approach to building lean, high quality, profitable businesses is I don't know if I know anyone else who matches it. And that's what I wanted to dive into. How has he thought about that? What is his framework for thinking about that? He's someone who this founder is still helping build out custom features when people email him on a daily basis, and yet is able to do it in a way that he doesn't just bottleneck him. He's built something pretty amazing. So we get into that as well. Really fun episode. If you want to jump just to the e-commerce stuff, you can jump about 20, 22 minutes in and you can get started there. But I'd recommend you stick around for the first part of the episode. It was a lot of fun where we talk about his framework for building businesses. Real quick before we start, running a 7 or 8 figure e-com business can feel pretty isolating. You don't always know if your margins are great or just okay. You don't know if your growth rate is strong for your size or if everyone else at your level is just crushing you and lapping you. You don't know if you should stay in on Friday night and keep cranking or if you should close the laptop and go out and celebrate big with your family and friends. And that is exactly why we publish the annual Econ Fuel Trends Report. We pull data from over 300 stores representing $3.5 billion in combined revenue from members of our Econ Fuel private community. Every important metric is broken down by revenue cohort. So you can benchmark your numbers for your store against operators and owners who are genuinely at your stage for an apples to apples comparison. And most importantly, know where you should spend the time to improve. It's free. It's at ecommercefuel.com/blueprint. And it will take you 10 minutes to figure out exactly where you should be focusing. Check it out. All right, let's get into it. Bryce, 7 years. Good to have you back. Thanks for joining.
Good to be back. Yeah, like time definitely flies.
I know it's 3 years ago, or 7 years ago, you were about 3 years into Metric, coming up on about 10-ish years now. And like I mentioned at the top, you know, I gave people a full in overview of Metric, how many stores are on the platform, you know, a quick overview of what you do, although we'll get into that in a little more detail. We're going to talk e-com. We're going to talk WooCommerce. But the thing that I admire the most about your journey in building Metric is you've done so on your own terms. You used to work for WooCommerce and Automattic, maybe getting and ended up leaving that to start Metric. And from a bootstrap the company. There's this quote when I was stalking you before in preparation for the interview. Yeah, you said the pathway of kind of venture capital didn't really speak to me. It felt like trading one master for another, and I could see that the freedom I was searching for wouldn't be found at the bottom of a seed round. And now you've built this thing, this amazing SaaS app, SaaS tool that does so much.
Yeah, I definitely consider it a SaaS. And I think that's also been one of our adventures early on. Like, we didn't pretend that we were just like a plug-in we really tried to lean into like, no, we're like a serious software product and a service that will like grow with you and will scale with you. And I think, especially in that WooCommerce world, people were really desperate to hear something like that 10 years ago. And just feel like, oh, wow, like you're not going to just charge me $100 a year and I might be able to get a reply every couple of weeks.
you were on the upper edge of that before people got subscription and SaaS fatigue. You were early on when the pain was enough that people were still excited about it. But I want to dive in. I would love to hear how running your team, you have four people, including yourself, you have a very meaningful business. I would guess that your profit for employee is among some of the highest in the world. Yeah. What are some of your rules and frameworks for making this possible, for being able to build such something, an amazing company with such a lean team?
Well, you know, it was when I was first started, it felt like I was the anomaly a bit. Like all around me, people were raising money. They were hiring teams faster than I could even just like get customers, you know, like they were just scaling up and it was just crazy. And there's definitely a moment I was thinking like, am I going to get like left behind? Am I going too slow? But I think being put into that situation where like, you know, I had this really like great job and fulfilling job and I got paid well and everything like that. So in that moment, I was like, okay, I'm trading something that I know is good, something that I think will be better, but that's no certainty. That kind of forces you to say, well, I'm now in control if this works or not. Like I don't have any, there's no like team or management I can blame, market, like it's all on me. And I think that really helped me from the start think, well, I want to keep doing this. So I need to make money and this needs to be profitable from day one. And it needs to be sustainable because I don't want to sprint for a year or two and then try to sell it, you know, for a few years of revenue. Like I wanted to build a really great business. So having that at like the top of your mind early on really helps shape every decision you make. And that goes as far as like early on having really good documentation, doing a lot of videos and guides and things like that. Because I was trying to think, well, like if I've got 500 customers, how am I going to support them all and keep developing this company? And yeah.
Fast forward 10 years to today, what are some of the things that you refuse to do? And what are some of the things that you have to do? Maybe what frameworks you have for running your business today to allow that scale with four people?
Well, I think actually, ironically, we do a lot of things that don't scale and we still do. And I think I'm very adamant about doing them and not being close-minded to it and being like, oh no, it's not going to work because it's not binary and things are changing all the time. Like I think early on, I was definitely much more happy to get on calls and do demos with customers. And at some point that doesn't scale that much. But now even 10 years in, we're still offering demos to like higher value customers and really trying to help them succeed with it, even though, you know, at a certain point with several thousand customers, that doesn't scale. But I think a lot of the decisions I make that have helped us get to this point is just really approaching things from like a, this needs to be profitable point of view. Like we just can't do things that don't have a very clear, like we'll put in this time and we'll get something out of it. And a lot of that is just trying to do things that scale really well. And so it is like still the same things, investing in documentation, investing in like the support experience so that people can get help themselves, but also like we can really like handle the incoming support well and answer people quicker with better results and better support. That's a very helpful way. But the other thing I think that I talk to so many like other SaaS founders and stuff like that. And the thing I always try to tell them, especially if they're early on in their journey, I'm like, you need to make money and take money off the table. Don't reinvest everything. Don't treat it like it's your one opportunity to have like a massive windfall one day. Treat it as a business, like as a almost like a job, but you need to get that reward from it. And I think there's two things for that. One is like it builds this independence outside of your business. So you actually end up taking more risks, even though you've got less money inside the business because you're like, well, outside of my work, like I know I'm good. I've got these different investments going. I'm diversified, all of that. But also it just forces you to like, yeah, I think a lot more like focused on profit and not just on like growing for the sake of it. It's like, well, I'm doing this to make money. So let me orientate myself to making more money from this so I can do more with it.
Man, this is a drum I have been beating hard the last 6 months on the podcast.
Well, it's especially relevant now in this, in uncertain times, profit is like a massive advantage.
I 1,000% agree with you. You mentioned customer service for AI. And I think something, there's a very direct parallel for people listening with e-com stores, 7+ figure e-com stores. How do I run customer service well? I know you have a reputation for having great service. And even on your webpage, I think it says like get great service from humans versus bots. But I think you also are smart enough.
Yeah, we're so proud of it.
Yeah, I think you're smart enough also though to take probably a tiered approach where people can self-service quickly and then it escalates. How do you talk a little bit about how you manage service through that whole spectrum? How much AI you're using when you escalate to humans, et cetera?
Well, to be honest, we weren't using barely any when it came to that stuff, that side of things. And I think that was very intentional just early on. We kept looking at it as Help Scout brought out more features because we're using them for customer support. And we're constantly trying because we're open to like new technology and new ways to approach things. But when you do have someone paying you several hundred dollars a month for software and they want help, like I don't want to send them in a circle with a bot. I think a lot of it just comes down to having empathy, right? And I've been on the other side where I've got subscriptions and I can't talk to anyone. I'm like, this is crazy. Like, I'm paying you a lot of money and I'm paid you a lot of money for years. If I just want to speak to someone for 5 minutes, like, make that possible. So yeah, I think empathy is important there, but we weren't really doing much. And it was really, we put a lot of resources and I mean, like videos, guides, like help docs and things like that, but, and also like enhancing the in-app experience when you got help. So a lot of things in our app, they'll be like, oh, you know, more information. And a big thing that we did was just showing the help doc when you clicked more information right in the app, like as a drawer that comes out. And I think, again, that just like makes it a lot easier for people to get help in the context that they're in. Because people don't want to reach out. Like a lot of times, if you can self-serve, you'd prefer to do that. Things are really exciting now because there's like all this like amazing technology that we can leverage. And one of those things was, well, personally, I was using a software product a few weeks ago. And as I was integrating it, I needed to check the docs and I was going to reach out to support. Cause I'm just like, since we do a lot of support, I was like, oh, I'll just get help. And I was like, no, I really want to get this working now. So I went to their docs and they had an AI chat on the side. And within two questions, I had it answered and fixed and I didn't need to contact anyone. So immediately I was like, okay, we need this for our docs because we were still using Help Scout's built-in docs. And I think that was such a wake-up call for me, by the way, because I was like, we were using the same documentation system for like 9 years and never stopped to think, could we be using something better? Because you get into these habits where you're just like, oh, things are working. And like, if I change it, what if I break my SEO? And what if I do this? And you start to like imagine all the things that could go wrong instead of actually thinking what could go right. Anyway, I've tried to put that aside. And then I had a look and ended up finding this amazing product. I've tweeted about a bit, Ferndesk, which is like just a really amazing software product. One of those ones you use and you're like, this is really nice software. Started using that for our docs and switched within like a day. And now we've got like AI chat in our docs. We've got a lot of like really great self-service features. And the cool thing is like we have visibility into that. So I'm actually seeing multiple tickets a day never start because they came into the docs, they talked to our AI chat there and they were able to find a resolution. And honestly, when you contact most software products, like that's how the support are handling it. Like they have, of course, their internal knowledge, but they are often just opening up the help docs and trying to figure it out for you. So it really is like I don't think it degrades the service. I think as long as you give people a way to contact you and you're not saying this is impossible to contact us now, it's a benefit.
I'm looking at Ferndesk now. Is this just a docs and AI system or is it also a full-on ticketing system and help?
No, it just covers that part. And that's what I really love about it. Like it could try to be everything and maybe they will one day, but like I don't want to change our support system. Help Scout's great for that. It's been solid and it works really well at that. The problem is they were always a support system. They were never a help docs system. So it was always an afterthought. And of course, you'd like to say like those things should be really heavily integrated. But I get that if they're going to prioritize one thing, they're going to prioritize the main reason people pay them. Just like we've dealt with similar feature things on our end where we're like, oh, okay, this is a nice feature that people like in the product, but most people are paying us for this feature. So let's work on that primarily.
Yeah, I'll have to dive into that. We use Help Scout too, but have been a little underwhelmed with the AI capabilities and the help desk or the docs. So
I have strong opinions about this stuff, like everything. And I don't really like the idea that you like send an email in and then you got like an AI response. Like, or yeah, like it simulates that kind of feeling of like a chat. Like I'm like clear, like this is an AI answers tool and this is not a human here. If you want a human, they're over there. But this is for people that want to solve it right away. But I don't like the idea of like, and I think of course the technology will keep evolving and it'll get better. But I do keep going back to that thought of like empathy and thinking if I'm paying several hundred dollars a month for a product and I want support, I want a human support because otherwise why am I paying you $250? I could just find a worse product or build it myself. And you start to realize, right? Like what is the value? Like what can SaaS provide these days in a world where like the cost of technology is getting cheaper? It's like it's support, it's humans, it's taste, it's all these things that AI can't do well right now.
It was interesting checking out Metric again since it's been a little while since I really, you know, kind of dove deep in what you're doing and you've added, it surprised me the breadth of what you're doing, like obviously metrics and reporting and analysis, but you've also added automatic reporting and an email suite and all these other things. And I'm sure AI has helped build those out. The question I'm curious about that I think is also relevant to people listening here on e-com stores. Obviously, the AI coding has been helpful, but for you on a day-to-day basis, what are you doing with prompting outside of coding that you weren't doing before? What are you able to build and manage and create from, you know, an AI prompt that has drastically improved your life? Or that
outside of metrics? Workflows? Oh, okay.
Not outside of metric. It could be a metric, but apart from like the hard code, the hardcore coding facet of things.
Not enough, honestly. And a lot of that is because like we're focused too much on our product and not like the tools that we use day to day. You know, we launched the MCP a couple weeks ago. And I mean, that's just been amazing to see how like people are integrating it into their like Claude and ChatGPT workflows and stuff. And seeing that, I was like, well, I would really love to talk with my data. That would be fun. And of course, there's lots of ways, you know, like to piece it all together. But they're difficult and we just don't have time and I think the desire to really invest in those things. But we've been recently, this has been like a long-term project, but I've really wanted to build a metric integration for Stripe so that we could use it as a customer since we're using Stripe for our billing, not WooCommerce or Shopify. And e-commerce and SaaS businesses are very similar. They are very different in a lot of ways, but when it comes to like the numbers, they are quite similar. They all have transactions, subscriptions, a lot of times products and similar kind of business models in some ways with costs and everything. So I do see a lot of similarities and like I've been working on that. So recently I've been able to like use just behind the scenes, our MCP like that customers can use, but with our data. And that's been amazing because I'm like finding insights that I didn't know about our own business. That's been pretty cool. But honestly, yeah, I've been pretty, I wouldn't say apprehensive with AI, but I'm like a generally cautious person. And especially since like it really started taking off last year and in the year prior, like when you're 8-9 years into a business and you're making money and things are great, like you're not really looking to like shake it all up, especially with like new technology that you read about is like deleting sites and leaking data. It's like,
it's so true. I think this is a reason, like I've had, there was a week, a night the other week where I spent 5 or 6 or 7 hours doing a deep dive on if this brand that I love that shut down, if I rebirthed it and brought it back to life, one, partially because I love it and I think there's potential there. But two, the more exciting thing for me was exactly what you said. The opportunity cost to screw stuff up with an existing brand is high. If you're coming back with something new or kind of that is you know not very valuable, then you have the permission or at least the bravery to unleash the bots and just see what you can do from a brand new world kind of thing, which sounds fun.
Yeah, exactly. And like I try to do that in a lot of different projects outside of my work because like my work is, the stakes are very high and like I treat them as such. But when it comes to other projects, like, you know, like little art projects I've done over the years, I'm really embracing AI in that and not even looking at the code. Or like other personal projects, like one of my big hobbies is like collecting records. I got quite a big collection and I'm constantly looking for more records. And I was able to like build this app on a weekend that I could kind of like my own Google Lens where I could just like take my camera, look at any of my records and instantly would look it up in my collection and give me all the details on it. And like technology like that is so exciting because I've always wanted that and I dreamt about having that as a feature, like a tool that I could use. And like AI unlocks it, especially when you're willing to like not care about the quality or about like the performance at those levels. You're just like, no, I've got something I want to solve and I'm just going to solve it. So I'm definitely, yeah, you got to, and that's like a big thing as an entrepreneur, you've got to take those opportunities, right? To like keep pushing yourself and growing, but not at the risk of everything you've built because then you won't have much to do either.
It's a super hard, and there's a real, just a podcast about this with a big Claude project that I did like 40, 50 hours really going deep. There's a huge anxiety tax that sits between most entrepreneurs and like what you can fully do with AI, getting comfortable with it. I mean, there's always that kind of trust and comfort tax and it takes a while to get through. I'm curious for you. So on the customer side, how many, and I'll tell you why I'm asking this question in just a minute. What percentage of your customers have come just organically word of mouth, you know, kind of versus paid acquisition?
I mean, again, I don't even know that number off the top of my head, which is a big issue because I'm
just ballpark, just gut feel. Yeah, if you have a hunch.
I'd say probably like at least 50% is word of mouth. It's been one of our biggest drivers over the years. And that's, yeah, I think it is one of those things where if you build a really good product that solves problems for people, people talk about that. Because like just like I was talking about Ferndesk and I've spoken about that a lot in the last month because it was a good product that solved an issue for me. So word of mouth was probably the biggest one. But we definitely have embraced paid ads. And I don't know the exact number, but I'd say at least 20, 30% has come from that over the years. Because when you're a SaaS and you've got the right margins and you understand really well your customer lifetime value, you can really invest in paid acquisition. I do actually encourage a lot of other WooCommerce, WordPress businesses I know to do that, and even Shopify apps, but it really depends on their pricing model. Because if you're charging $30 a month or a couple hundred a year, you don't really have much to play with. Yeah. And that really goes back to that idea of like, I think it is often better to build a really powerful, strong product that you can charge several hundred dollars a month for. And also just to have a pricing model that scales. And I'm constantly telling other SaaS founders, like, if I can't pay you more than $100 a month, that's all you're ever going to get from me. You need to have a way where someone can pay you $500 a month if they get enough value. I'm not saying they have to, but like create that pathway where there's enough value being extracted that they're willing to pay several times that.
Yeah. And the reason I asked that was the more and more, especially e-commerce matures, and even looking at our own business model, the more and more I think that just doubling down on your product quality, investing more time there. And I think having a split with paid traffic is really helpful. One thing I've changed my mind about this last year is that like really investing heavily in paid, assuming you know deeply how it works.
Don't fly blind.
It's actually, yeah, it's a really good, is a smart strategy. Don't abandon it. But that probably the best thing you can do is just build a great quality product, because everything is downstream of that. Whether you're in SaaS, whether you're in e-com, everything gets improved and magnified. Word of mouth.
Every metric.
Everything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Paid ads, if you get that really working really well, yeah, you're going to have a lot of trials coming in. But that, like, you're still going to convert them. You're still going to retain them. And that, like, those things aren't made easier because you're doing paid ads. They're made easier because you have a better product.
All right. Some e-com questions. I had to geek out. I love the mentality with which you operate. I had to ask some questions here. If we didn't have an e-com audience, I would spend another 2 hours to talk about this. But I want to give some, make sure that we're talking about stuff that's really relevant to people listening in the e-com side. WooCommerce, Metric, WooCommerce has been your world for years and years and years. Metric is what you plug in exclusively to Woo, unless I have missed a memo about something.
Yeah, we integrated with Shopify a few years ago. We're very bad.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. You did? I'm not good at like, Andrew, look what we did. Like, because I just like, I don't know. I think part of that's my Australian nature, but like, yeah. We're taught very young, at a very young age, don't brag or like talk too much about your achievements, like keep them to yourself. So I'm very bad at marketing.
Great for making strong relationships, terrible for marketing. Okay, so WooCommerce and Shopify.
And potentially more. And I think especially in the current environment we're in, where like it's never been easier to roll your own e-commerce software or integrate with custom ones. I think it's becoming more and more important to actually do things like that and integrate, to be like less opinionated sometimes about like platforms and we're currently WooCommerce and Shopify, but that split, and people always ask me that, it's like probably more 80-20 to Woo.
Yeah, because Woo's from your roots, of course. You said more. You know, when I think about, we were having this discussion in the ECF forums recently about Shopify and the pros and the cons, and you know, is it a good price, $100 on the investing side, and are they monopoly, are they doomed with AI, all this kind of stuff. And one of my points is like, when I look at hosted SaaS shopping carts, I mean, yes, you can maybe, apart from vibe coding your own, which I don't think is a good solution for most people, where are you going to go apart from Shopify? Like when I look at the landscape, it's either Shopify if you want hosted, it's Woo if you want to get in and play with yourself. Like what are the other options out there that are reasonable for people?
Yeah, I don't think there are that many. Like there seems to be a lot of like more niche or like regional related ones. Like, okay, we're going to be like the best one in France, the best one in this region, which again, yeah, taking like thinking from a customer's point of view, that actually can be quite good. Like, oh, you're going to help me handle the shipping gateways in my country and all that. But I don't think that is relevant. I think WooCommerce actually has an amazing opportunity right now. And I think isn't threatened, but rather like is given an advantage by AI because, you know, we spoke about this earlier, but like, yeah, the barrier to entry with WordPress and Woo is generally quite high, especially compared to Shopify. That kind of goes away now. WordPress and Woo, they're definitely embracing like the new world we're in. And like you can now control and edit a WordPress or WooCommerce site completely through AI chat. Like you don't have to go into the admin and navigate that anymore. So as that comes further along and like develops more, I think when you start to then make decisions based on price and you're like, well, Shopify is going to cost me X% of all my revenue. Woo's going to cost me the same, less 1%, I'm going to go with Woo. And especially, I think, as you start to scale and the numbers make that much of a difference, it's like, yeah, you could save $1 million a year on platform costs if you rolled it yourself. You can hire two people full time just to manage that and still end up ahead.
Yeah. Have you seen, and the data on this is probably hard, so even anecdotal kind of thoughts or stories you've seen, given your perspective, have you seen a lot more people starting to actually use Woo since coding with Claude and AI has gotten so much easier?
Not yet. I don't think so. I think it's been the other way around for so long where like, yeah, and I don't think that's a secret, but a lot of people have been moving from Woo to Shopify over the years. And I suppose we see a bit more of that because we're mainly dealing with Woo stores. So we're seeing them move. But we also just don't talk to many stores that were like, yeah, we're on Shopify, we've moved to Woo. Like that does happen. And I think it will happen at a more frequent pace now. But in the past, that hasn't been how it's gone. It's gone the other way. So yeah, I don't know if we're there yet. But I think Shopify is also, it's just an incredible product and an incredible value proposition that they offer. So when I talk with friends and they're starting up an e-commerce store, like I'll often just recommend they use Shopify, especially early on. I'm like, well, if you know, you get to 5 or 10 million a year in revenue, like at that point, it might be worth considering your options. But early on, like you need to remove all the hurdles that are in your way. And Shopify is so good at doing that because it just, yeah, I'm seeing friends that have zero developer experience get into Sidekick and they're editing their theme with Sidekick. Like that is, yeah, amazing. Yeah, kudos to Shopify for that.
You have this amazing, we were talking about our different reports that came out kind of roughly at the same time. Yeah. And we both have things we're envious about each other's. But the thing that I'm really envious about yours is like you are plugged in just like a neural jack into the dashboard of 3,000 stores real time. We were kind of reminiscing a little bit about COVID and how you could see that the spending spike as the government stimulus came out and people spent all of the money they just received in the Armageddon on big screen TVs, which made me question.
Well, also just during COVID, what was so fascinating is like we started looking at that aggregated data on like an industry level and we're just like, oh, wow, okay. Obviously like camping is really taking off, but then almost immediately when lockdowns like stopped, it's like, boom. And similar like alcohol. And then you kind of see like all these trends happening in real time. And it is really fascinating because like you have zero control over them. You're just an observer, but you're seeing it in such a like, yeah, vivid way.
Yeah. And so I think about, yeah, almost akin to like a bank teller, you know, or someone in the banking industry, you have x-ray vision in a way other people don't. When you think about the top 5 to 10 stores that you have that x-ray vision into, and of course, anonymously and just kind of in general trends, the top 5 to 10 stores that you know that are defensible, that are really profitable, what do you feel like the couple of things they are doing especially well are in terms of commonalities?
I mean, it would vary because like, yeah, if I looked at our top 5 or 10, they're almost all in different industries, sometimes on different platforms, different setups. The thing that I've seen work really well for the bigger stores is like, they don't gate information inside their company. So they're like actually actively inviting like a lot of their team and encouraging them to look at the analytics and like look at all the data and try to improve things. Because like if everyone's flying blind, you can't really blame them when they don't come to you and report a problem if they couldn't even see it. So I think that's definitely one of the separators. The other one is just like, yeah, I think definitely a focus on, I don't know, like looking at the details, like actually like not just looking at things on a very macro level, but like the ones that really dive in and try to understand problems, and you see like even the management team come in and they're like trying to identify like what happened with a certain customer or certain situation. People that are really detailed orientated tend to spot those little issues before they become big ones.
Yeah. It's one of the things that I took away from our recent e-com camp, which is our event for larger store owners, is
that looked amazing, by the way. I would, yeah, I need to try. I want to start an e-commerce store and eventually come.
It was a really fun time. And yeah, just maybe repeating for people who heard, but the number of owners of large mid 8-figure businesses, sometimes 9 figures, had a much closer finger on the pulse of the details of their business than I think people would expect.
Exactly. They could tell you, you know, who their biggest customer is or what, like this product is always selling well, but out of stock. Like they really understand that at that deep level. And a lot of people say that doesn't scale. Well, I don't know. I disagree. You've seen that with them. And even for me, like I'm still managing like some failed payments and really trying to understand, okay, why is that customer in those areas? Why are their payments for metric failing? And how can I fix that? And really trying to get into the details because yeah, big things, small things become big things if you don't keep an eye on them.
Yeah. Okay, I got a little bit of a cheeky question here. You know, you called Metric. You have the visibility in all these stores. If you could only, let's say you start an e-commerce company selling records, you love it, you're going to come to e-com camp in 3 years, the fastest person to hit, you know, eight figures in ECF history, but you only get three metrics to track for your, let's say, $4 or $5 million. Let's say you're at $5 million. You only get three metrics that you get to manage your company by. What would be those three metrics?
Okay, like my customer acquisition costs is key. I need to understand that. Like the retention and churn, like understanding those metrics, because if you start to have that, you can build a pretty good model of, like, you know, how much success you're going to have. A third one, I don't know. But like, I'm thinking more like, because again, you know, we're talking about this, like e-commerce businesses and SaaS businesses are not that different. The numbers that I'm looking at are probably very similar to what e-commerce business looks at. But for me, it's always like, how much does it cost me to acquire a customer? How long on average can I expect to have that customer? And I suppose, yeah, like what will my like lifetime value be from that customer? If I can measure all of that, I have all the formula, like all the variables to adjust everything as I go and optimize. What are yours? I don't know. Now you got me curious.
Oh, for and I feel like it'd be a little different. Would it be for a SaaS model or an e-com?
No, e-commerce. Yeah.
E-com. Yeah. I think I would say, that's a big one. I think you're right. I think definitely looking at, you know, kind of lifetime value, but not from a revenue basis. I would look at kind of contribution lifetime value. So what's my profitability lifetime value? And that varies based on your overhead and other things, but on average, that would be one. I think the second one I would look at is, oh man, it's not as much fun when you ask me the question. Actually, I have to be intelligent on the spot. Contribution margin lifetime value. I think I would look at probably my number one channel of like my most profitable channel, right? Because if you're thinking about marketing from the perspective of, you know, from a limited lens, I would say just what's my highest channel from a contribution margin? And then I would focus everything there. And then I think my third one would probably be overhead, because overhead is just such a massive, either overhead or, well, contribution margin would probably be tied into my product margin. So that is already encompassed. So I think overhead, yeah, as a percent of rev.
Oh yeah. I mean, I agree. And like, that was something that surprised me. Like we launched a feature earlier in the year. Like we've always had this cost and profit feature. So it is so important for e-commerce stores to track that. We launched like a feature for having operational costs. So just like overhead costs and rent, salaries, anything that didn't fit into like the actual cost of goods being sold or transaction costs. And I was like, oh, maybe a few people will try that. And like immediately, like hundreds of stores were like setting up all their operational costs. I'm like, that's, yeah, that's like awesome, but also surprising. And I do think, yeah, it's like, it doesn't matter how much revenue you're doing. If you're not making any money, you're not going to be lasting longer than the month, like going until your next credit card statement's due.
I love that you have that built into Metric, because it's that a lot of places will stop it, just like the unit economics, and they don't tie that in. You got to figure it out based on your own.
I mean, and this is more going back to the earlier conversation we're having, but like in a world where like the cost of software is getting lower, where anyone can build anything, like I think for how a SaaS company survives that is they have to provide a tremendous amount of value, much more than they had to before. And it can't just be value in one area. It needs to be this holistic kind of thing that's like, yeah, you could vibe code an operational cost system, or you could vibe code this, but like, can you build a whole coherent, you know, software product? Hopefully not. Maybe eventually, but then we'll just have to keep going further ahead and like trying to create more value. But it's like, I'm building all these features now that I thought we'd get away with never having, because I'm realizing like, if we want to keep growing and keep creating enough value for people, like we ultimately have to. Like, people don't want to use 20 different tools anymore. They want a handful of really good ones that they'll pay for.
Yeah. And it's impressive with what you offer there. We'll get into that in a second here. I want to go into your report here as we kind of, before we wrap things up, and kind of like a little bit of a rapid fire on some of the stats I found interesting, but quick thoughts on sample size. So this represented 65 million orders, 6 billion in revenue, which really annoyed me because it was twice as big as my survey. Bone to pick with you. And plugged into 6,000 stores, which is very cool. So Stat number one, maybe I'll read a handful of these. And
this is only WooCommerce, by the way. Like, we don't have enough Shopify data that we're confident to report too much on that.
Got it. So only WooCommerce. But the average Woo owner running a WooCommerce relies on 58 plugins on average. Is that right?
It sounds like a big number, and it is. But I think a lot of the times, like, they've got small plugins that do one thing. And it's like similar, I guess, to Shopify apps, where like there are a lot of apps that just do a really tiny, tiny modification. But it is a bit of a shocking number. And I think, I can't remember the top number in there. It was like 200, one store had 250, something
yes,
like that.
Yes, I think 200 plus. Yep.
Yeah. It's crazy. But I mean, that also is, in one breath, it's crazy. The other one, it's amazing that like the store's running and the stores are doing significant volume, even with all those plugins. Because yeah, the technology at some point doesn't matter that much, or it doesn't matter as much as maybe we think it does. That's probably the lesson there.
Yeah. Next stat that was interesting. The AOV was highest during weekdays, which is not a shocker. It was 20% lower than normal on the weekends. Work hours had the highest AOV, and peak AOV time for the whole week was Tuesday at 11 a.m. So, you know, I thought that was just interesting that you could kind of isolate that.
Like, I couldn't tell you, like, oh, this is because of this and this. I could come up with some ideas, but it's a lot of surprising stats like that. Then I think, you know, you could convince yourself like, oh, it's probably because of Monday they're not shopping because they're getting back to work, and 11 a.m. because they've woken up. And it's, I don't know. You could try to figure out a reason, but
I think all e-com owners will tell you that people shop at work like crazy, but it was fascinating to see the degree to which they do that in the data.
Yeah, so. Yeah, 100%. It's easier to spend money while you're making money. Honestly, and a lot of that is, yeah, like, you know, the mindset they're in is like, oh, well, I'm at work, you know, this week's good, I've got my income, so like, yeah, I'll buy something.
I love how you break down all the stats by industry, and you had a section where you talked about refunds and the high, you know, from a refund rate perspective. And actually, it's interesting because when I was doing that 6 or 7 hour deep dive with like all the LLM tools about relaunching this brand, it was an apparel company. I was curious about their refund rates. So the highest refund industries, the two highest that you mentioned were apparel, which 6.5% of orders get returned. Consumer electronics was at 4.3%. Which kind of surprised me. And the lowest refund rate, which made me laugh, was the cannabis industry.
I guess it's a bit hard to refund something once you've smoked it. I mean, yeah, that's such a fascinating industry. Like everything, all the rules you think you understood about business, and it just goes away. It's like, nah. And we see the same thing with like all these emerging industries, peptides and things like that, where it's like, yeah, everything you thought you knew, forget it. It just doesn't work like that.
Either can't return it or you don't want to.
Yeah, yeah. Or you're just lazy enough that you don't want it.
Yeah, yeah. Or after you smoked it, you know, motivation's gone. Can you talk a little bit about what you saw from a percentage of, what percentage of orders are happening on mobile, and why are desktop orders still pretty valuable from an AOV perspective?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, maybe that's all the boomer in all of us. Like I think a lot of us like don't want to make really big transactions on mobile at a certain age bracket, right?
Yeah, agreed.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know. I'm still like that. And I think I'm quite young, but there's like a lot of people that are younger than me, and like they're spending, they're happy to maybe make those transactions on mobile. Like they might book a flight. Like I've never booked a flight in my life on my phone. And the thought of that gives me so much anxiety. That's a desktop transaction. I know a lot of people feel similarly. And it's similar, yeah. If I'm going to buy like a consumer electronic, like a $2,000 device, like I probably want to just be on a computer to do that. And I don't know why that is. Yeah, mobile, I definitely, especially in the Shopify world, and like not just Shopify, with Woo, it is getting easier. But the friction to like do a transaction on your mobile is so much lower. A lot of times all your info is pre-filled. So I still think that's why you see like most orders are happening on mobile these days. But when it comes to like bigger transactions, they are going to be on desktop. And that's why you can't really ignore either.
Yeah. I think the stats you had were 72% of orders are happening on mobile, but desktop orders have an AOV that is almost 2.5 times bigger.
It's just, yeah, it makes sense. Like, a lot of those numbers I look at, I'm like, really? And then I try to like, just think, well, how would I actually go about life? And what would I do when it came to like making a transaction on desktop mobile? And yeah, okay, I would probably spend more on a computer. You also like, it's a bit more of a serious thing. Like I'm on the computer. Like, yeah, I can see everything. I can look at all my bank accounts. I can look at everything at once. While mobile, like you're very like focused on that one task.
And it's easier for impulse buys, right? Like, you know, you're on a, there's something in a mind space about it. I'm on the couch. I'm kind of flipping through. So, okay. Yeah.
It's just like, it just happens to happen, right? Yeah. While a desktop, it's like, I'm opening up my computer. I'm going to make that transaction. Like, yeah, this is a thing.
I thought the free shipping was interesting. You're not surprising, like, you know, 74% of orders include free shipping. But the threshold for the AOV for free shipping is actually going up. So I think it was this year, it was $123 was kind of that threshold for where people unlocked free shipping. And that's that threshold has increased about 11% in a couple of years. So I thought that that was an interesting.
Cost of shipping is changing. Yeah, we're definitely seeing that. And I'm sure you are. As it becomes more expensive to send things, it doesn't mean that free shipping is going to go away. It just means that like the barrier to get it might go higher. But it is probably one of the most underutilized methods of like increasing your AOV. Offer free shipping. Like just keep looking at where your AOV is. If it's at 120, free shipping at 150. And like keep pushing that because it makes sense as a consumer as well. Like I will always end up spending more to get free shipping. Like, yeah, I'm very bad about that. But especially living in Australia, it's like, well, if the difference is like $50, like I'm going to spend $500 extra to save that $50 because the shipping money is like, it's gone. Once you spend it, it's like, it disappears. But the item you got, well, I still got all those items I paid for. And that's why you start to see like, it's no surprise when you think of it like that, the AOV gets a lot higher as you get further away because it's like, well, this is a more of an event again like that. So I need to take advantage of the situation and I might not order often because I've got to wait 2 weeks or 3 weeks for the item to come. I want to get all my items in that one transaction rather than split them out.
Any one or two other things from the report that really surprised you or you thought were notable worth mentioning?
No, I think like the free shipping one was definitely the one that caught my eye. I think it's just, yeah, I find that so fascinating because I think it's just really one of those levers you can clearly see, like, yeah, we increase the free shipping threshold and we're going to see an increase in AOV. But yeah, I think like a lot of the industry stats were so interesting, but they're also different depending on what metric you're looking at, right? I think a lot of it is like trying to like ask yourself, well, what are the numbers that I care about and what are the things that I'm thinking about? I saw that, you know, with some customers, like they were a lot of times, like when I'd show them the report, they're just like, oh, this stat's so interesting to me because this directly relates to my business and what I'm dealing with and confirms like how I'm thinking about a certain metric.
So where can people get the report and download this? It's such a cool report, especially if you're industry specific. It's amazing for benchmarking on that. Where can people download it?
It's on metric.com/insights. So we can put a link in, but metorik.com/insights. I think should have it. Yeah, you can look it on the website. Like we just want to make it really easy for people to get this data because we know like from a user point of view, when you as a store have access to this data, you can make a lot better decisions. So we're like, well, if you can have this for several thousand stores, that should help. And the other thing we're always trying to do with this report is like shine a light on like how much revenue and goes through. Ooh, it's pretty amazing. And I think people just think that, yeah, like there aren't many serious stores in WooCommerce, but like, yeah, we deal with thousands of like very big successful businesses that make their living through a WooCommerce store. But, you know, I gave a talk about this recently at a conference I was at, and it was a WordPress oriented one. So I was really trying to drive home, like, we need to stop thinking of Woo as like a competitor to Shopify because like they lost. Woo lost a long time ago. If that's the measure of success, like with Shopify, like Shopify has won in that area. Their product's incredible. They do significantly more GMV every year and they deserve it. Like they've built an amazing company. Woo is really good at solving different problems. Woo is really good if you want to own your data. Woo is really good if you want to customize every detail. Like in that way, Woo is winning. But I think you can't treat it as like this binary thing where it's like one platform is better than the other. Like they're both better at different things for different industries and different stores types.
I mentioned it at the top, what Metric does at a high level, but give people a sense. It's such an impressive product. And it's a product that not just does a lot, but does it well. Like when I look at, we have an internal review directory at ECF and it got a 4.9 out of 5 ratings across like 25 ratings, which is, you know, pretty significant. So give people a sense of what it does and what it can do for their store, because we've talked around the edges, but give the full brief.
I'll try. I'm not very good at this. But like, please just try it and you'll see. No, but I think it's like our whole mentality is like, we don't treat our users like idiots. We're like, you know, you are running serious e-commerce store, so here's a serious tool that you can use. But we don't try to overcomplicate it either. Like, I want the CEO to be able to use it. I want the fulfillment team to be able to use it. We want like it to be very accessible. At a top level, we're like a reporting analytics app. So we're like sucking in all that data and trying to give you like insights on your really top line stats, like customer lifetime value and retention and conversion rates, but also dive deeper and understand like, based on the first product to customer purchase, what average lifetime value can you expect a year later versus different products and cohort analytics. But then the other side of our product, right, is like this email automation and like, I'd say more like the action side. There's like one, analyze. Second part is to action those insights that you have. So we do like email automation, cart emails, newsletters, and tools like that. But at a top level, most people are coming in and like trying to use us for reporting and to understand their store better. Why I think we've done well is what I mentioned before, like this focus on trying to make it a very accessible tool that isn't daunting and isn't like too technical, but it's still very powerful. And like, we do that by like giving people really great segmenting and like letting them segment by all the custom fields and all that extra data they have, but also listening to customers. And a lot of times we'll get a message like, I need a segment, a filter for this very specific thing. We're like, well, if we can do that in a non-invasive way that helps at least a handful of people, we'll add it. And the other part to that is like, well, it's great to give people a number. They need confidence in it. So I think why people tend to like our reports is like, when we give you a number, you can just click on that number and view all the orders or all the data behind that number. And yeah, like a lot of times it's like, you might have like misconfigured the configuration, like for the filters, or there may be some data that's incorrect, but like, we'll just give you the tool to figure that out. We're not going to like tell you that your numbers are wrong or that our numbers are wrong. It's like, we're giving you a number and we're telling you how we got that number. So you have that full understanding of the process from order to report.
The full audit trail is there. And one of the things that I've seen in reviews, one of the many reasons people love you is people, exactly like you mentioned, they're like, yeah, I needed a feature. And Bryce, the guy who like started the company, emailed me back and he's like, we can build this, which
I still do that every day. Like,
which I think like just blows people away. And it's one of the cool things, one of the cool things about the business model that you've built, for the business, I should say.
Well, you build the kind of company you want. And that was like, I always wanted to do that. And the moments that I've gotten away from that and I'm not involved in that are the moments where I like don't enjoy it. Like, and I woke up today to a ticket from a customer who was just like, give me some feedback on that MCP. Said, oh, can we have this feature and that? And I added it yesterday. And he's like, amazing. Like, you're one of the companies I love I look forward to reaching out to when I get support, because I know you'll add it. And I'm like, that makes me so happy. Like, I don't care what features we build. It's more like when you have those reactions from people and they're like, they feel like you're their partner and not just like a service that they use. It's a really like wholesome feeling. So I love it.
Probably not inconsequential to one of the reasons you've been so successful. Make sure to check out Metric if you're looking for amazing reporting. And also, Bryce didn't touch on a whole lot, but a full-on email suite as well.
Yeah. I should talk about that feature more, especially since we just include it and it's like cheaper than Klaviyo and everything. We're like, yeah, we should talk about it. And that was all pre-AI, I was like, yeah.
I could see from your seat, Bryce, two perspectives. One being like, oh, I'm glad that it's so great we have AI now because we can build all these things. And then I can also see the other perspective where you're like, why didn't we wait to build this until AI was rolled? That would have taken us, so much less time.
And like, it's funny, we'll just be sitting here and like, we're like looking at a feature together, like, is this pre-AI code or post-AI code? And then Eric, a guy I work with the other day, was like, wait, how did you build this without AI? Like, it was just like looking at a feature. I'm like, when you don't have something, like, you find a way. Like, I can't imagine doing that today, but.
You're like, I locked myself in a room for 8 weeks and drank Soylent and coded and it came out.
Pretty much. Yeah.
It was rough. It was a rough period of my life. Make sure you check out Metric. Again, it's spelled M-E-T-O-R-I-K. And you can, of course, the software, but then also download that report. It's such a cool report. Bryce, I want to ask you one last question here as we wrap up. I kind of have this theory. I've mentioned it maybe once or twice on my podcast that I think the ideal sweet spot for entrepreneurs is, you hear entrepreneurs complain about just running wild, stressful businesses that just dominate their life for 80 hours a week. And then they sell said business, and then they go into existential crisis, and you know, end up buying their Ferrari, and you know, like they don't know what to do with
end
their life.
End up on Fat Fire on Reddit.
End up on Fat Fire on Reddit. You know, just obsessing over what do I do. I believe that the sweet spot for many entrepreneurs is to have a business that you enjoy running 80% of the time, that you can run for decades. And I think my just question for you is: do you any thoughts or nuance or how do you react to that?
I think it should be a company that you'd be happy to run for decades, but that you don't have to either. Because I think being forced to do that, it becomes a bit of a prison, even if you enjoy it. And it's like golden handcuffs and all those kind of terms. So I think, build a business that you'd be happy to run for decades, but you don't have to either. And that there's potentially a path out of it earlier. But a lot of that also, I think, comes down to like, you need to have interests outside of work. And that interest need to be more than like your family or like core living things. Like, I like eating. Yeah, that's a great interest. Everyone likes to eat. But like, have an interest that like a hobby or a passion. And I would really try to find things. And I know it's really hard for entrepreneurs, but like try to find hobbies and passions that have zero economic benefit. Maybe even the opposite, like a game or like building something where like you have no intent to sell it. Because that's where you start to get a lot of fulfillment, and where like entrepreneurship and having resources to fund those hobbies is actually amazing. Like you can go so deep into a hobby and really explore it when, you know, you've covered the monetary side of it. That's a really big advantage that I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't do, because every decision needs to be financially driven. And they're like, well, you know, I'm getting into this hobby, but like long-term, I'm going to end up selling these products to do with it. It's like, no, stop. Just enjoy the hobby. You can enjoy it in an excessive way, but like keep it as something that like isn't focused on like turning a profit. And I think you get a lot of fulfillment out of that.
Love it. Great place to wrap it up. Bryce, congrats on building such an amazing tool on your own terms over the last decade. And always, as always, love chatting. Hope we can do
this. Thank you for your support. Oh, I mean, over the last decade as well.
Oh yeah. It's very easy to put behind with a product and team like that. Look forward to next time we get to do it. Thanks, sir.
Likewise. Appreciate it.
Before you go, here's a number that stuck with me from my research this year. Store owners who rate their financial knowledge a 5 out of 5 has almost 50% higher net margins than owners who rate themselves a 4. Same businesses, same industries, but going from pretty good to confident was worth almost 50% more money in their pocket. If you want to close that gap, check out our Financial Mastery Series course. It's a free course built specifically for e-com owners like you that you can download at ecommercefuel.com/mastery. And if you're a 7 or 8 figure store owner who wants to be around other operators taking this stuff seriously, make sure to check out our community at ecommercefuel.com. Work hard, adventure often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.